This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. It's time once again to discuss this past week's important news with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
We are going to start in Europe with a new agreement between its two most prominent countries, France and Germany, an agreement that reflects the changing geopolitical climate with Britain and America withdrawing from Europe. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard.
Yes, this is a treaty that's going to be signed on January 22nd. Usually on this show, I don't bother talking about things that are going to happen. We kind of wait until after they've happened. But I think this is such an important deal, treaty, it's worth talking about. And I could definitely see us coming and revisiting it as we learn more of the details after the fact. So in 1963, Germany and France kind of signed a landmark treaty that was meant to set out their relationship post-war going forward. And that 1963 treaty has been the foundation of French and German relations. And what they're doing now is they're updating it. They're bringing together, so it's almost like it's meant to just really symbolize a new relationship between the two, a complete overhaul in the relationship between the two. And what I think is most interesting about this, again, this is all about symbolism, the place that they're signing it. That was the LSE Treaty in 1963. This one is going to be the Aachen Treaty, because they're planning to meet on January 22nd in Aachen, Germany. And if you've been following the Key of David for the last few months, for example, you'll be very familiar, well, both with the Franco-German relationship, but also with the city of Aachen, because this was the capital of Charlemagne's Holy Roman Empire, where he really brought Europe together in a way that hadn't been brought together since the Roman Empire, and did that in this almost theocracy where he used bishops very heavily in his administration. And this is the heritage that so many leaders go back to again and again when they're talking about the European Union. So by signing this treaty in Aachen, they're claiming the mantle of Charlemagne, and they're saying, well, our aim for France and for Germany, even before we get into any of the specifics or the details of the treaty, just with the symbolism around it, our aim is a new kind of Charlemagne-type relationship, a new kind of Charlemagne-type even empire in Europe, a new unity in Europe founded along the same lines as Charlemagne. So that's this treaty coming up in just 11 days now.
That is really stunning symbolism in light of, as you said, everything that Gerald Fleury has been saying about that. The cover story of our Trumpet just a couple of editions ago, the new dark age, hearkening back to that Charlemagnian past and the Holy Roman Empire, and they're being quite open about it.
Yeah, to me, this is one of the most exciting things about this story, is just it does build off of just exactly everything, some of the biggest articles that we've had from Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury after the last few months. The cover issue of the latest Trumpet print edition is all about the Franco-German relationship, and it's about how France is turning away from America and turning to Germany. And it's like almost before we can get that magazine through people's doors and on your mailbox and I guess I was going to say through the letterbox and on your doormat, but you guys have a different mail system in the States. But almost before we can get those magazines out, we've had just more on this very dramatic story. And just going back to that article where the main theme of Mr. Fleury's article on that latest Trumpet print is about how France is turning away from America and to Germany. The preamble of that 1963 treaty really emphasized the relationship with America. And it just said, we're coming together, France and America, France and Germany, we're coming together, we're being friends, but this is all in context with our relationship with America. That's really important, and we want to make sure this is at the foundation even of our bilateral relationship. This new treaty has nothing like that, and that's probably one of the big reasons why they're updating the 1963 treaty. It's a big symbol of them moving together, but also a big symbol of them doing so without America.
So it's clear what the overall effort here is and the way that they're defining this and the symbolism, as you've mentioned. Can you give us some of the details of what's in the treaty?
Yeah, I think one of the most eye-catching, I'm not sure at this stage whether it's more of a gimmick or significant, but they're setting up Euro districts along the border is one example, where it is, again, this is all about symbol and about symbolism leading to a superstate in this case, where, you know, normally you have the French side of the border and, you know, all the buses go within France, or the public transport networks within France, the mail networks within France, the utility networks are within France. Over the border, you have Germany. Fine, there's no border there anymore, but all of the public transport networks link in with Germany, etc. They're going even further now to erase this border and to make it so that you have, say, combined transportation routes covering these two borders. You know, almost like cities straddling the border that are neither fully French nor fully German, but are merged together. I think it reminds me a bit of Berlin after the Berlin Wall came down, where you had two systems that didn't interlink at all and then merging them together. So this is what they're doing along the Franco-German border. Another very eye-catching specific is they intend to push for Germany to get a permanent seat on the UN Security Council. We talked about this either last week or the week before, where Germany's got that temporary seat there. But France has said, with our permanent seat on the UN Security Council, we're going to try and help Germany get one too. And that's, again, well, that one's very symbolic and very practical, a push for both of them to work together on the international scene. There's also more commitment to push for a united military and more commitment for the two of these countries to kind of get together, sort out what they want, and then turn around to the rest of Europe and kind of make that happen for Europe, kind of making sure that these two stay in the lead of Europe and that Europe dances to the Franco-German tune.
So it seems like France has always had this desire to create a situation where it's really like the co-equal leader of Europe, but there have been a lot of criticisms over the years, and even with respect to this new treaty, that what's happening in fact is that France is empowering Germany. Essentially, this is cementing Germany's leadership role over Europe. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I think that is absolutely right. I mean, you look at the economic role, that the leadership that Germany's been able to have over Europe since the Euro crisis. That 2008 crisis in the aftermath is where it became suddenly clear to a lot of people that Europe was not a Franco-German alliance. It wasn't led by a Franco-German combine. If anything, it was a Germo-Franco combine, or just Germany in the lead. You know, you saw the way that they called the shots when it came to all the bailouts, because they had the money. What you've got now with this new treaty is it's France bolting itself on with Germany, but at the same time, that economic fundamental hasn't shifted. Mm-hmm. Germany is still the most populous country in Europe. It's still the biggest economy. They're going to still dominate in that same way economically, so they're going to dominate in this relationship. And then you've got France playing along. I think, you know, you mentioned the way that France has enabled Germany in Europe, and I think the thinking in France for a long time has been Germany has a lot of power, probably more power than us, but because of their history with the Second World War, they're going to be reluctant to use that power. Therefore, if we hug them closely, we can take advantage of their power, we can exert the leadership, and we can use their economic power to our advantage.
Some dangerous assumptions there.
It is. And you look at some of these other things that we've been talking about over the last few weeks. You know, Germany rediscovering its history, its perception of its history changing. It's the way its leaders saying we need to stand up more forcefully. We need to throw our weight around. Mm-hmm. The way they have behaved in the Euro crisis, it's clear that assumption doesn't hold anymore. But that's, I think, what France is banking on. And that's why their approach is fundamentally flawed.
Yeah. A lot to unpack there, and we will be reporting on that. As you said, we'll follow up as this unfolds and we get more details. But we do have an article that's getting ready to go up on thetrumpet.com. It should appear shortly, if it isn't there already, by Josue Michels about this exact subject. The title of that, the Elysee Treaty 2.0, a new Franco-German friendship treaty. You can find that. And there are links to a lot of the Key of David programs and the material that Gerald Fleury has been producing on this. Go and check that out. We appreciate that, Richard. Now, while France and Germany are making these diplomatic efforts, one important foreign policy consideration is Iran. Iran is very pushy in its provocations, its support of terrorism, and so on. And Bible prophecy says it's actually going to push Europe into a violent retaliation. To learn about some recent developments on this front, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, if we weren't looking for this prophecy to take place, the fact that Iran and Europe are on a collision course, then we wouldn't really think that this story is such a big deal. But because we're looking forward to that and that fulfillment in biblical prophecy, we're highlighting this story this week, which has to do with the European Union coming together to actually sanction Iran, enact specific financial sanctions on a couple of Iranian agents, and also Iran's internal security and intelligence ministry. Over the past couple of years, there have been numerous assassination attempts and successful assassinations of Iranian dissidents on European soil. That's what this is all over. These were attempts that were organized by the Iranian intelligence ministry back in Iran, and they have been successful a couple of times, killing a couple of people back a couple of years ago in the Netherlands. And then over the past 6 months, there have been attempts in Denmark, attempts in France, and one other nation, I'm not sure, I can't remember right now. And so Europe has finally got together and said, this is too much. You can't be acting on our soil to kill off, in many cases, European citizens. And a couple of cases they were in this. And so they've come together finally and said, we are sanctioning Iran. And while this is, as the Wall Street Journal called, just a baby step towards greater action, the Wall Street Journal hopes, and obviously the United States hopes, against Iran, it is significant because since the nuclear deal was enacted back in 2015, there have been no sanctions placed on Iran by the Europeans. And this just might open, start as a trickle and open the floodgates that shows that Europe is aware of what Iran is doing.
Just out of curiosity, what's the reaction in America after Europe has been so critical of the United States for the sanctions that it's imposed against Iran?
Well, Europe was very clear that it was saying that this was had nothing to do with the nuclear deal, and we're still in that. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo came out and he thanked the Europeans. He basically said, this is a great start. Come join us now. Let's ratchet up the pressure on Iran. There hasn't been too much of a response from the European Union to him. Obviously, Israel was very happy about this as well. The Israeli Foreign Ministry said that this was an important first step by the EU combating Iranian aggression. Iran was not happy with this, obviously. Their foreign minister came out swinging. He's the smiley man, Javad Zarif, that was in all the nuclear negotiations. He came out and said that, well, basically there could be reciprocal action taking place against European nations. And so Iran obviously wants access to the European markets. And so it's going to stay for as long as it, or trying to partner with Europe for as long as it can in terms of the nuclear deal. But Europe, by this action, is showing that, you know, Iran is on notice, that they will act against Iran if pushed.
I don't know if this is how well you can answer this, but it does seem like there definitely are competing interests within Europe. There maybe we could say competing schools of thought in terms of how to handle this type of thing. There's more of what we might call the status quo traditionalist European model that is much, you know, very slow to take action in a situation like this. But we have seen in many European capitals the rise of something more aggressive, something more combative. What does this these measures, which school of thought, if I can put it that way, does this reflect?
Well, it is interesting because, I mean, you had the Danes that were absolutely furious when they found this plot back in September, October, and they wanted to enact sanctions right away. But you had to get the whole EU on board, the 28-member bloc. And so it took a couple of months for these sanctions to be enacted. The foreign ministers are coming out and saying that this is a European move. It's showing that we can act together in a coordinated manner. It's a strong signal from the EU that we will not accept such behavior, that we can respond clearly and significantly when our borders are crossed. So they're dealing with this in a purely European sense. But they were all the foreign ministers of the states themselves. I didn't hear a comment from Federica Mogherini, the EU foreign policy chief that is so pro-Iran, that was involved in the negotiations, that has family ties with actually Iranians and such. She didn't come out and say too much about this. And so you have these individual
something that it's almost a little bit more grassroots.
Yeah, it seems like this comes from the nation states themselves, and they've rammed it through using the through the EU. So I don't know whether it is the Brussels that is doing this. It seems that it is more of European nations coming together that are directly affected by it, rather than a bureaucracy, which I think is something that Bible prophecy as well shows. You are going to have strong nations that stand up, that assert their will collectively, rather than just a decision-making body in Brussels taking that mantle. That is not what's going to happen.
Well, it does. We talk so much about this this push and the retaliation by Europe, as is prophesied directly, explicitly in Daniel 11 and verse 40, and that whole passage. And you would expect that there would be this more popular movement and this this frustration among Europeans at Iran getting away with these types of activities and having to do something about it. Brent, I'd like to go ahead and just transition into your second story. We were talking about Germany and France adjusting to a post-American Europe, in a sense, and even that last story shows their Iran policy maybe taking on some of that flavor. U.S. President Donald Trump's recent announcement that America would withdraw its forces from Syria surprised a lot of people. Many of them were concerned that this is going to empower Iran. The U.S. Secretary of State, you mentioned Mike Pompeo, he's been touring the Middle East trying to reassure nations about America's policies there. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's really interesting to watch this play out. Because even when we reported on Mr. Trump's December 19th decision, I think it was, to say he tweeted, we're going to get our boys out of Syria, the 2,200 troops, and his own government was just shocked by that decision. Obviously, we had Defense Secretary Mattis that resigned over it. Brett McGurk resigned over it. He was the envoy to the ISIS mission, to the coalition that are fighting with the United States in Syria. And even it really did... this decision to remove troops from Syria fly in the face of a larger aim that the United States had, and that was to counter Iran. You had both of these ideas. Can we bring our troops home, which the president wanted to do, and still counter Iran in the region? And those troops in Syria were one of the greatest beachheads against Iranian domination in the region. And so this week we had National Security Advisor to Mr. Trump, Mr. Bolton, touring the Middle East. And then we had Secretary of State Mike Pompeo follow up with him, touring all the different allies to reassure them that though we do want to get our troops out, and though that has actually started today, movements to get some of those troops out has started today, we are not removing ourselves from the region. He said in this very important Cairo speech, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo did, that when the United States leaves, that chaos ensues. And so he's telling everybody, we're not leaving, we're not leaving, we're not leaving, as far as our commitment to the region and our commitment to this anti-Iranian coalition, but at the same time, troops are leaving. And so they are in damage control right now, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Mr. Bolton, trying to reassure these allies in the Middle East that the U.S. is still a factor. But really, what's interesting through all this is the allies aren't reassured, because they know that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, doesn't make the decisions. John Bolton doesn't make the decisions in Washington. President Donald Trump makes the decisions, and he makes decisions on a whim in some cases. And so while you have the U.S. stating that it's going to be here against Iran, I don't think there's many allies that are so reassured by that.
Right. You would expect that they would be a little bit confused by the Secretary of State insisting that they're going to remove every Iranian boot from Syria at the same time that he's saying, no, we're absolutely going to withdraw our troops from Syria. How do you remove Iranian boots from Syria through diplomacy?
Right. I mean, I think you've got these two ideas, these two combating, ideas from the president. He wants to remove troops, but he wants to counter Iran. He was voted in on the fact that he wanted to focus more on America, but also counter Iran, pull out of the nuke deal and all these other things. The Republican base loved that. Finally, somebody standing up to Iran as opposed to what we had for 8 years under President Obama. But what the actual changes on the ground to that policy or President Obama's policy haven't been visualized much at all. It's just been a lot of words. And even this speech that sounded so great. I mean, if by Mr. Pompeo, that sounded so great in Cairo and such a sea change from President Obama's speech 10 years earlier, when he opened up his hand to the Iranian mullahs and said, without preconditions, let's get a deal done. And basically said, you can have free reign over the Middle East.
Yeah. And Pompeo was definitely, he wanted to draw that distinction. 10 years after Obama's Cairo speech, here's the new Cairo speech. So it definitely had that flavor to it. Stephen Fleury talked about that on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show this morning. No question that he's trying to draw a very clear distinction between these two administrations. And yet, what's happening on the ground just doesn't reflect that.
Not at all. It doesn't. And, I mean, without a U.S. presence in the region, without U.S. forces on the ground, Iran is looking at this situation, and yeah, they might have some financial hardship right now, but they're going to wait it out. I mean, the president has shown that he has no stomach to stay in the Middle East. When he was talking about his off-the-cuff comments last week at a cabinet meeting about Syria were just stunning. He basically said Iran can have it. That's what he actually said. Iran can have Syria. All that's in Syria is sand and death. Sand and death. I want to bring our men home. And then you've got Mr. Pompeo saying, no, we're not giving up on you, Syria. We're going to, you know, keep on with our policy until Iranian boots have left from there. And everyone else in the region is saying these two don't go together. You cannot say we're out of here and that's not important and then come out and say that we've got your back. That does not work in the Middle East. And the Middle East leaders that have, especially those that are enemies of the United States, they'll just bide their time. They won't take this as a strong step by the United States, just speaking in Cairo.
For further information, where would you send people, Brent?
Well, actually, I would jump on the back of what Mr. Fleury was talking about on the Trumpet Daily earlier today and send people to Great Again. It talks about how while we have a stronger a leader, while there is a great change from President Obama right now with President Trump, fundamentally, in terms of foreign policy, it has been more of the same in many ways. This isn't going to announce a great resurgence of American power in the long run in the Middle East. And the reasons why for that are detailed in that booklet.
Thanks very much for that, Brent. You are listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Seems like every few weeks, news emerges in America of another major business or even government agency getting hacked. A health insurance company, a credit reporting agency, your bank. Well, it appears there are people who have collected quite a lot of that stolen private information and plan to use it. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, China appears to be constructing a vast and really detailed database, not of information on Chinese, as we would expect, but of stolen information on American people and companies. And there are reports that all of this data that Beijing is compiling on Americans could be used for intellectual property theft, extortion, blackmail and that sort of thing. So as you said, we hear about these kinds of hacks on U.S. organizations so often that it becomes easy to kind of dismiss them, especially because often there's not immediately anything that seems to happen as a result of them. But I did want to remind listeners of a few of the notable hacks from the last few years. In 2015, Anthem, which is an American health insurance company, disclosed that hackers linked to China had stolen sensitive information on up to 80 million individuals. Later that same year, the U.S. Office of Personnel Management announced that 21.5 million records belonging to 4 million Americans had been stolen in a cyber attack originating in China. And those records included sensitive information about people who had undergone background checks in order to be considered for U.S. government positions. That one, from a national security perspective, was probably the biggest hack to date, at least that we know about. And then in November of 2018...
That's a good point.
Yeah, many of these, it's often 2 or 3 years later when the company will say, okay, we can't stay quiet about this anymore, back in 2015. Mm. So it takes a while. In November of 2018, Marriott announced that for the last 4 years, their servers had basically been wide open to Chinese hackers, and the information on as many as 500 million customers had been stolen, including, you know, passport numbers, credit card information, probably what kind of movies they were renting in the rooms while they were staying at Marriott. Many of the individuals whose information was stolen were affluent American business people who travel for work quite often. The very next month, the Wall Street Journal reported that Chinese hackers had stolen highly sensitive classified information from U.S. Navy contractors. We talked about that on the Trumpet Hour a month or so ago. And other incidents of this kind include a huge 2004 hack on Sandia National Labs, a 2006 attack on the U.S. Commerce Department, 2009 infiltration of America's F-35 program, and a 2010 attack on Google, Yahoo, and Dow Chemical. And the list just goes on and on. And so this week, cybersecurity expert Daniel Meisler put all this together. And he wrote about this really disturbing trend, and he said, it seems obvious at this point that China is building a massive database of information on American individuals and companies. The idea that a highly organized state-level adversary is actively building these kinds of databases on us and using that information however they can to secure victory, that's just extremely frustrating and exhilarating and surreal all at once. End quote. So I don't know if I necessarily share in the exhilarating part of his assessment so much, but this is a hostile government that is actively working to bring an end to the age of U.S. global leadership. And to think about just how much data they have on American individuals and companies, that really is surreal.
So he's basically connecting these dots, and he says it seems obvious at this point. Is there any additional evidence that would support that besides just, you know, one man who is an expert in this field using his imagination to try to put that together?
There is. Back in 2016, even before many of the most alarming hacks were revealed, the Epoch Times published an exclusive interview with an insider in China who was helping the Chinese government to build this database. So, you know, this man only spoke to them on the condition of anonymity, but Epoch is a reputable publication, and other sources had confirmed to them that this man's identity was what he said it was, and that he would, in fact, have access to the kind of information he was sharing with Epoch. Mm. And this insider said China is indeed building a massive database just to handle all of the data on Americans that they're stealing with, you know, with cyber attacks and other kinds of espionage. And he said that to create the spy database, the Chinese government brought in a small group of independent software developers from the United States. So these Americans worked alongside Chinese security branches to get the system going. And
shameful.
Even the fact that these Americans, you know, were there helping, I think that that could have been the result of blackmail, you know. Come over here and help us, or else we'll show the world your Google search history. Hmm. Or it could have been massive bribes. Come and do this one job, and then you're set for life. But in either case, the report is really chilling, and I think all this adds up to show that China really really probably does have that information on file that it could use to blackmail government employees, to recruit insiders as spies, and who knows what else.
So we talk about how this factors into biblical prophecy whenever we talk about hacking and just how technology dependent where we are. Maybe you could just bring that angle in.
Yes. Yeah. America's cyber vulnerability is something that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury he's really been warning about this since 1995. He first wrote about it in 95, warning that the dangers of the country being reliant on computer-based technology that is vulnerable to hacking is probably our weakest point. In an article at that time, he quoted a security analyst who called this dependence our Achilles heel. And then Mr. Fleury wrote, quote, "America is the greatest superpower this world has ever known, but we have a very vulnerable point in our military, our own Achilles heel. It's so dangerous that I'm amazed it hasn't received more publicity." And then he said that studying into this this vulnerability reminded him of a Bible prophecy in Ezekiel 7, verse 14. This passage is mostly about the modern United States and UK. And it says, "They've blown the trumpet, even to make all ready, but none goes to battle, for my wrath is upon all the multitude thereof." So that's it's a prophecy just about a future time when U.S. technology will have been apparently hijacked and compromised by enemies. And Mr. Fleury wrote this about it. He says, "It seems everybody's expecting our people to go into battle, but the greatest tragedy imaginable occurs. Nobody goes to battle, even though the trumpet is blown. Will it be because of a computer terrorist?" So the news from this week about, you know, China's ongoing hacking and compiling of all that information on Americans, it just shows how vulnerable many computer networks are, and it shows the kind of leverage U.S. enemies could already have.
Mm-hmm. Well, very fascinating, and Jeremiah's written an article that should be going up on thetrumpet.com soon. You're on file. China's building a huge espionage database on Americans. You can check that out, as well as that article that he referenced, America's Achilles heel, from Gerald Fleury. And you can check those articles out on the show notes for the program today. Just go to thetrumpet.com and visit the Radio Hub. We will include links to all of those articles and more. Well, we are going to take a short break here. And if you are missing Andrew Miller, all of those Andrew Miller fans out there that are waiting for him to speak, you are in luck. It's coming up next. We're going to talk about the battle in America over a border wall. And he's also, later in the program, going to talk about the American Psychological Association now saying that traditional masculinity is harmful. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
The United States government is in the midst of a partial shutdown over a disagreement between the president and Congress about funding a border wall. For this story, we will finally turn to Andrew Miller.
Thank you. President Trump actually devoted his first primetime Oval Office address yesterday to this issue. Addressed the nation from the Resolute desk. Calling for the need for a border wall, talking about the humanitarian crisis that's happened from illegal immigrants streaming over the border and attempting to get the public on his side. If you'll, I mentioned a couple weeks ago on this program the government shutdown. That's the big issue with the current government shutdown, is that the Congress is trying to negotiate a budget agreement, and President Trump and the Republicans are not voting for any agreement until there's funding for a border wall, and the Democrats are not voting for any agreement that includes funding for a border wall. Mm-hmm. So we're now into day, I think it's day 19 by my count, of the, I guess, the partial government shutdown.
It's a big game of chicken.
It is a big game of chicken, and it looks like, I mean, I've had a few people ask me if I had any guesses when it's going to be over, but I don't think anyone does right now, because it seems like both sides are pretty entrenched. It is just a symptom of just like how divided the nation is. It's actually, President Trump, he's been, I guess, trolling his followers on Twitter with posting. He keeps posting videos of speeches, Barack Obama, or at least one speech I saw of Barack Obama calling for a border wall during his presidency. So,
yeah, you can find quite a lot of tape of Democratic leaders saying how important it is that we secure the border and that we put a wall up there. They agreed with it at one point.
Right, yeah. So there's that seems to be a mixture of, one, just how radically the Democratic Party has shifted, that they're now overtly the party of open borders, and also a little bit of a commentary on just the natural hypocrisy of politics. It's, you see the same thing with the debt, where you can get speeches from Senator Barack Obama talking about how George Bush was destroying this country with his reckless spending, and then he spent twice as much money as President Bush ever did. And now President Trump is on track to be just about as bad as President Obama on that count. So there are no fiscal conservatives, but there's definitely a fight over whether we can spare $50 million for a border barrier or
$50
not.
Million, or he's talking about like $5.8 billion, something in that realm.
Yeah, I guess that's possible. I've seen, I know they're going to need more money than he's asking for in this current round of budget.
Well, it is interesting to hear President Trump talking about the crisis at the border, and Democrats insisting that there's absolutely no crisis at the border. And meanwhile, they're talking about the crisis of the government shutdown, that all of these government workers, this is creating chaos because they're not getting their paychecks. And even Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is talking about the chaos happening in Washington, D.C. area restaurants who can't employ their workers because they're having to flee the country out of fear of the president. So there's a crisis on both sides. It's just, I don't know. I haven't been feeling that crisis of the government shutdown.
No, there's always a libertarian part of me that gets a smug sense of satisfaction when I find out the government's been shut down for 3 weeks and my life hasn't changed at all. But it's like 9 departments that have cut their budget 10%. So it's not even like a real shutdown. I think the last time they had one of the shutdowns during the Obama administration where they had to like shut down the Lincoln Memorial for the government shutdown, but it's totally in an open plaza. So they actually had to like spend taxpayer dollars to pay a security guard to keep people away from the Lincoln Memorial when they could have just walked up there otherwise.
Right.
So it's a... Yeah, it's childish, but this is prophetic in the fact that we've mentioned on this program before. Deuteronomy 28 is called the blessings and cursings chapter. It's the blessings God gives a nation for obedience, the cursings He gives them for disobedience. Israel specifically, which includes the United States and Britain, as Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong's booklet, The United States and Britain Prophecy, explains very well. But one of the curses they actually list here is open borders. In Deuteronomy 28, it comes in 52, where it's talking about that. It's talking about like a foreign power. He will besiege you in all your gates until your high and fenced walls come down wherein you trusted throughout the land. He shall besiege you in all the gates throughout all your land which the Lord your God has given you. So making the point that like God gave the descendants of Israel this land, and they've erected in some places, maybe not as many as some would like, some high and fenced walls that they've trusted. And now you'll see this interesting political divide where you've got the Democratic divide, which thinks that the curses God prophesied are actually a good thing. God said open borders are a curse, and they think that's what we want. And then you've
got the interesting point.
Republicans, who are smart enough to know that the curse is a bad thing, but they put all their trust in the wall, when the whole point of the chapter is that these are curses that come on you because of sin. And so they can. We'll see how this fight plays out, whether the wall gets built and comes down or just doesn't get built at all. But the verse is pretty clear that you're trusting the wall, or at least the conservative half of the nation is trusting the wall more than God. And so the wall will come down.
Mm. Well, where would you send people for more information about this, Andrew?
Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has a book, Great Again. Particularly, there's a chapter there on where America's race riots are leading that discusses some of the issues associated with out-of-control immigration and the Bible prophecies behind that.
All right. Great Again. Getting more love on today's Trumpet Hour. We appreciate that, Andrew. We spoke earlier about this meeting between Germany and France as they seek to define European politics and Europe's future. Well, another meeting took place by two other countries aimed at putting forward an alternative vision of Europe's future. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this really is the other half of the first story. I think you put the two together and you get a good picture of where Europe's coming. So you had Matteo Salvini, the interior minister from Italy, traveling to Rome. And you know, he was meeting with the various different political parties there that are or political leaders in Poland, including some of the, you know, the figures that don't necessarily hold office, but are the actual powers within Poland and within that that political party over there. And well, I think it's really, you look at the headlines that came out of this. One of them is God and Russia dominate Salvini trip to Poland. Another one, Italy's Matteo Salvini woos Poland's populists. And we talk on this program, and you even kind of alluded to it in Brent's segment on Iran,
right,
that you have some of these leaders within Europe that don't agree with the Brussels bureaucrat vision for Europe.
Yeah,
they don't really like this open door to migrants, this very secular liberal view of Europe that you have. And so with this meeting, you had two of the most prominent ones get together, and well, they talked a lot about true Christian values. Was one of the things that came up a lot. A new equilibrium. Matteo Salvini, while he was over there, he said that Europe must return to its identity, to its Judeo-Christian roots, which is rejected in Brussels in a crazy way, where family values are rejected. But you're getting two of what are really probably the most religious, at least most Catholic countries in Europe, with Poland and Italy, getting together and pushing a very different view for Europe's future. And I think one of the reasons this is so important in particular this year is they're set up for success. You've got European elections coming up, and it's this brand that could well become they don't have that big of a representation in the European Parliament right now. That could change majorly with the European elections this spring, to the point where these guys start to get their hands on the levers of power, not just in their own countries, but at the European level. And Politico just had a great article this week where they drew attention to how this could fundamentally change what Europe looks like. They wrote that the headline was "Thought Populists Want to Kill the EU." It's worse than that. They want to reform it in its image. And just one of the top quotes from there, they said, rather than dismantle the EU, which is the way a lot of people talk about this, but rather than dismantle the EU, far-right populists could help accelerate the militarization of the EU in order to project collective power into states along the EU's border in a quasi-imperial fashion. Mm-hmm. So these guys, they're not talking because they want to do a Brexit or a Quitterly or a, I don't know what, a Plexit, whatever Poland leaving would be, pull out of here. You know, they're doing it because they have a different vision for Europe, and they want to try and push that vision this year. And it's a vision for a more muscular Europe, military Europe, and more Catholic Europe.
And interestingly, we're talking about Italy and Poland, but you'd have pretty significant segments of the populations within France and Germany as well who would be very sympathetic to this view. And these leaders seem like they're very aware of the fact that, you know, they're having this meeting at the same time that France and Germany are having their meeting, and they're almost talking about it as if, you know, this is the real future of Europe, in contrast maybe with that that more mainstream view.
Yeah, and that's why I think what you're seeing is kind of the two halves of Europe come together here, because pushing Europe forward in two directions that are going to come together in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, you know, France and Germany, that meeting is very significant, and it's really going to cement Germany as the leader of Europe. And then, as you say, a lot of people within Germany like the Polish-Italy view of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's a lot of evidence that that view of Europe is what's coming to Germany, what is going to come to power in Germany. And when that does, you know, then you've suddenly got everything in place. Then you've got Germany with France as assistance has developed this position where they lead Europe. And then you know, you can bring in this other side of things, this muscular foreign policy and this Catholic heritage. And you've got the Europe that we've been forecasting since, well, even before World War II, but especially then in the aftermath of World War II. Herbert W. Armstrong was saying, you're going to have 10 nations in Europe come together. It's going to be a Catholic power, and it's going to be imperial, just like this article talked about, with this quasi-imperial. And it went on to talk about Europe getting involved abroad, getting involved in the Middle East, like Brent was talking about.
Mm.
And Mr. Armstrong said all that because of Bible prophecy, because Revelation chapter 17 says that you've got this union of 10 kings, and it's led by a woman, which in Bible prophecy is a church. In this case, it's a prostitute. It's a false church, but it's led by a church. And so you can really see Europe developing towards that. And for years, you know, Mr. Armstrong said consistently, this is where Europe's going, but they're not going to get there until they bring the Catholic Church into it. And now you're seeing these hints of that Catholic Church being brought in. And it's because, you know, for years you'd have said, well, you're crazy to think that Europe, that the Catholic Church is going to have a bigger role in Europe. The EU is secular. Brussels is secular. But because of those prophecies, you know, he made those forecasts, and you can now really see a lot of those forecasts now being fulfilled.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. And we'll put links to a couple of articles. And I think Mr. Armstrong's booklet, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast, certainly comes to mind. For more information about this, it's critical that you you familiarize yourself with those prophecies that tell us what Europe's future is going to look like. We appreciate that very much. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Germany and France aligning, Italy and Poland. Now we're going to talk about Russia and China. More movement on this other prophetically significant front to start the new year. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, here we are just a week and a half into 2019, but there's already quite a lot of evidence coming together showing just what a momentous year it looks like for moves toward greater cooperation between Russia and China. Yesterday, news broke that Russia's central bank dumped around $100 billion in U.S. holdings and then picked back up about $44 billion worth of Chinese yuan. And Russia picked up the remaining amount in euros and the Japanese yen. So that was largely in response to new U.S. sanctions that were imposed on Russia last spring. But the shift means that Chinese yuan now accounts for about 15% of Russian reserves. And it means that Russia now owns roughly a quarter of all global reserves held in yuan. So that's very significant because it's about 10 times more than any other country. And then back in November, Russian President Vladimir Putin said, "We aren't ditching the dollar. The dollar is ditching us." And he spoke about just the instability of dollar payments in nations like Russia because of the constant threat of U.S. sanctions. But now this news report shows that Russia really is diversifying away from the dollar in what looks like a pretty significant way. So that was big news. And then on the same day, Russian nuclear energy firm Rosatom announced that it'll be helping to build China's new CFR-600 nuclear reactor. And Russia also said that it'll be supplying nuclear fuel for the reactor as well. So it's not necessarily anything too surprising there because we have seen Russia and China cooperating in the nuclear sector in recent years. But the nuclear sector is really sensitive for nations to be sharing information about their, you know, their programs with each other about. So it is something to keep an eye on. And then this week, the data also came in saying that the trade volume or the volume of mutual trade between Russia and China hit a major milestone last year. It finally reached $100 billion for the first time ever. So trade's at an all-time high, and 2019 is on track to see that volume continue to grow even more as Russia and China keep on looking for ways to draw closer, and especially ways that they can do it that kind of bypass the dollar and just diminish U.S. power.
The alignment of Russia and China is one of the pillar prophecies that we look at all the time, and you just see more and more evidence of just this exploding relationship. It's quite phenomenal.
It is, yeah. A few short years ago, each of these items would have warranted a full-length article, I think, right, on thetrumpet.com, and now we kind of have to just bullet list them just because of how rapidly it's picking up momentum. But we do have a detailed article on our website called Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China. And one quote from that says, "For over half a century, the Trumpet and our predecessor magazine, The Plain Truth, have been expecting Russia and China to partner up. We've expected it because Bible prophecy says that in the time of the end, the Russia-China axis will lead an Asian military bloc that'll play a central role in nuclear World War III. And then it says the fact that the Russia-China axis has now suddenly arrived means the fulfillment of these Bible prophecies is astonishingly near." So we'll have a link to that article, and it examines numerous specific Bible passages prophesied, you know, or they were written thousands of years ago. Passages like Revelation 9:16 and Ezekiel 38 are covered thoroughly in there, and it explains that this axis will play a major role in nuclear World War III. And when we see these two nations building nuclear reactors together and ramping up trade and holding each other's currencies in really significant volumes, we really should see that as setting the stage for the next and final world war.
Well, thank you very much, Jeremiah. We've got a couple minutes left here for one final story. The organization that literally writes the book on what is considered sane and insane in America has issued new guidelines for men and boys that are, well, I'll just say it, insane. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the American Psychological Association, I mean, it's come a long way in the past half century or so. I think it was 73 that they declassified homosexuality as a mental illness. And then more recent than that, that the transgenderism declassified as a mental illness. And they haven't gone quite so far as saying traditional masculinity is a mental illness, but they're definitely saying that it can be harmful because it leads to homophobia and sexual harassment. Mm. According to the statement they made, they said the main thrust of the subsequent research is that traditional masculinity, marked by stoicism, competitiveness, dominance, and aggression, is on the whole harmful. That's from their news release that came out. So that's basically, you know, like emotional repression, being competitive, being dominant, being aggressive. They're saying all these things are associated with traditional masculinity and should be avoided, which is quite shocking for an organization that's supposed to be rooted in science. Right. Is that you'll... I have a biology degree, and you know that there's some of those things like competitive, dominance, aggressive. There's molecular explanations for that. And as long as you haven't, through faulty diet or other things, thrown off your hormone levels, specifically your testosterone levels, the aggressiveness, the dominance, the competitiveness is something you've just got to deal with. A traditional masculinity is the social conditioning that channels that energy into good and constructive channels.
Right.
If you don't have it, that's why you go to like kids who grow up in bad family backgrounds or bad father's background sometimes join gangs. I mean, the aggression's still there. You got to do something with it. If you don't actually have the societal training that like, okay, well, this is... channel it into doing well at school, or channel it into protecting your sister, or channel it into this fruitful endeavor or that fruitful endeavor. You use it for selfish ends.
Right.
And so these these things, specifically the sexual harassment point that they're, the American Psychiatric Association is now saying is due to traditional masculinity, is actually due to a lack of it. You've got biochemical urges, but no society, social training on what's the appropriate outlet for that. And then, of course, we have, you've written the book that we offer here on biblical manhood that goes through in more detail, like scripture by scripture, how that what they're calling traditional masculinity is really biblical masculinity, because they're not necessarily all in one place or one chapter, but throughout the Bible, there's specific scriptures on how God wants you men to channel that natural competitiveness, dominance, and aggression that comes with their biology.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, that is going to have to do it. We appreciate that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that it wraps up another episode of Trumpet Hour Week in Review. You can visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to the articles and the literature that we discussed. Email your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to this panel of distinguished gents, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Honored to be here.
Thank you very much.
An honor to be here. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I couldn't agree with you more, Richard. I'll leave you with the words of Dan Harrod. Love is like a tennis match. You'll never win consistently until you learn to serve well. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.